This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Forgetting to have fun. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
As you get older, it's easy to find experts in illness, grief, geriatric health, and social welfare. But where are the experts in having fun?
Can't relate at all to getting older, can you?
No.
Hawaii and Guatemala have made news lately for volcano activity, but guess how many volcanoes are actually active in a single day?
The biggest challenge at the U.S. Open Golf Tournament this weekend may have nothing to do with tee shots, fairway irons, and putters.
And why Tiger Woods is popping pills on the golf course.
Well, you know, he's had a successful return from his fourth back surgery now, and part of his routine in coming back is taking ibuprofen in the middle of his round, just as more of a preventative thing.
Wall Street Journal reporter Brian Costa on Tiger Woods' pill regimen as he plays the U.S. Open this weekend. That story in about 20 minutes. We're coming to you today from the Dell Studios. Dell Small Business Technology Advisors know there's nothing small about your business. They provide one-on-one partnership and reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors to get business done. Talk about daunting. The front line of the effort against the dangerous opioid fentanyl can be found in a cavernous hangar at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago, patrolled by drug-sniffing dogs and sharp-eyed X-ray machine operators. Their job? Figure out which of the tens of millions of parcels that pass through there each year might contain the powerful synthetic drugs blamed for a soaring rate of fatal overdoses. More from John Kyleman, reporter at the Chicago Tribune. John, set the scene.
Primarily, they're coming from China. They have a vast pharmaceutical industry there, and some people there are selling these over the internet, mostly, not too hard to find. And the shipping route they prefer is the Postal Service because they find that to be a more reliable route than, say, you know, FedEx or UPS or shippers like that, mainly because surveillance of their packages requires not just them doing it, but the country of origin doing the same. FedEx and UPS can kind of control that process all the way along the line. And the problem the Postal Service is having is that other countries' national mail carriers are not as efficient or not as willing to collect information that might help investigators figure out when drugs are coming into the country.
What'd you find when you looked into the journey that these deadly packages go through?
Well, what happens at O'Hare is it's a giant international mail depot, and when packages come through, every single one of them is x-rayed. But however, you're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of packages each day, 55 million a year. And, you know, opening every single one or really giving them a close scan is just simply not possible. So they kind of do the best they can, which is, you know, after a while, when they find certain things, they'll look for some hallmarks. You know, it could be the country it's coming from, could be, you know, the shipper it's coming from, could be the way it's wrapped, could be, you know, the way something shows up on an x-ray, but that's a highly imperfect way to try and stop, you know, the flow of extremely potent drugs.
We're speaking with Chicago Tribune reporter John Kyleman. So what can the federal government and drug enforcement agents do?
Well, that's a good question. What they're trying to do is have these other countries get better at, you know, doing their own surveillance and tracking to try and, you know, cut down on it on their end. I know that the federal government has tried to, you know, put some pressure on China in particular to rein in these rogue pharmaceutical manufacturers. I don't think that's really borne any fruit yet. But the problem is, I mean, you can make these anywhere. It doesn't have to be China. It could be, you know, some other country. It could be here in the United States. It doesn't take a genius to manufacture this stuff. And, you know, what some people I spoke to believe is that, you know, even if the federal government becomes, you know, great at detecting these, there's just too much of it. It's too easy to make. There are too many possible routes to come in. So thinking that you're going to stop it is really not realistic.
So are there things that FedEx and UPS have done that the post office is unable to do?
Well, it's just that when you send something through them, you have to put your name down. You have to put your address down. You have to say what it contains. Now, obviously, no one's going to be honest about, if they're sending something illegal through there. But, you can use that information. You know, if there's one particular address that you know that drugs are coming from, you can keep track of every single package that comes from there. That's not a requirement of every other postal service in the world. So some of them are quite loose. I saw packages at O'Hare that had been sent through, government shippers that, you know, their manifest didn't have any of that information on it.
Thanks, John. John Kilman, reporter at the Chicago Tribune. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Olympic gold medalist Shannon Miller is a TV commentator, motivational speaker, and advocate for women's health. She is also a cancer survivor. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
With 7 Olympic medals, gymnast Shannon Miller is best known for her tumbling and flipping, but it hasn't always been gold for Shannon, who was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. She joins us now to talk about her efforts to raise awareness of ovarian cancer as June is National Cancer Survivors Month. Shannon, when and how did you find out about your diagnosis?
It was a shock, I think, as any ovarian cancer diagnosis is. I was diagnosed in early 2011, but it really started in late 2010. I had called up my doctor's office to cancel my exam, and I was going to be busy, and I was going to be out of town during that time, and I thought, well, I'll just postpone it. I'll put it off till next year. It's no big deal. I feel fine. And while I waited on hold, I just felt this guilt. Here I am, an advocate for women's health. It's my passion. It's what I do every day. And I just took the first available when the receptionist came back on the line. And it was that very morning that my doctor found a mass on my left ovary.
So you had no inkling that anything was wrong, or did you?
You know, I look back and I realize, and it's one of the reasons why I'm so outspoken about the issue of ovarian cancer awareness and making your health a priority, is I look back. And I know that I had 3 of the major signs of ovarian cancer. I was bloated. I had horrible stomach aches. I had lost weight suddenly. But I was so busy. And my son had just turned 1 year old. So, you know, my focus just wasn't on me. I wasn't listening to my body in the way that I should have. And I talked them up to women's issues and nothing too serious. In fact, I actually told my doctor that very morning, I feel fine.
Shannon, how was it treated and how are you doing now?
I'm doing great. In fact, last weekend I celebrated 7 years cancer-free, so I'm very excited about that. I had surgery to remove my left tube and ovary along with the tumor and followed that up with a pretty aggressive chemotherapy regimen, BEP.
We were speaking with Olympic gymnast Shannon Miller. Shannon, I guess hearing those words, there are a few things that could be worse. What kind of advice do you have for people who receive a cancer diagnosis?
Keep fighting. Keep fighting every single day and utilize the resources that are available. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so excited to join with Tesoro and share my story and spread the word about the Our Way Forward program that they have, because we have to utilize these resources, the education and the tools that are available to help us change the way we talk about ovarian cancer. And whether that's you as a patient, families, caregivers, health providers, we have to understand not just the physical toll that it takes, but the emotional toll that an ovarian cancer diagnosis can take, and not just that diagnosis, but throughout treatment and then post-treatment, the concerns of recurrence, all of those things go into it.
Shannon, in addition to raising awareness of ovarian cancer, what are some other things that you're involved in these days?
Oh, goodness. There's always something going on. Like I said, as someone who's involved with health and wellness for women, we're always involved in different projects with regard to fitness and nutrition, motivation, and certainly cancer awareness is a big part of that because it is so personal to me.
What is the most challenging part about being an Olympic athlete?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I think the most challenging part is retiring. you love it. I grew up doing gymnastics. I enjoyed it so much. Not that there weren't tough days, but I loved competing. I loved putting on the red, white, and blue and going out and representing my country. And so kind of the day it ends, you kind of wonder where the family went. And you still in your mind can do all the skills. And my body won't do that anymore. So I think just being able to relive those memories and take those friendships with me for a lifetime, I mean, that's just amazing.
Are you involved anymore in coaching or mentoring?
I don't do any coaching. I stay involved primarily as a commentator and analyst. So that's a lot of fun for me. Every Olympics, I get to watch these athletes walk out on the competition floor, and I know what they're feeling, the butterflies, and it's just incredible to watch these athletes perform, certainly at the level that they do these days. I would not want to be competing with them now.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Olympic gold medalist Shannon Miller. It's 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Tiger Woods is popping pills during golf tournaments, but it's perfectly fine. It's ibuprofen. The mid-round medication has become a form of preventive maintenance for Woods, who has said he's feeling better than he has in several years. And for him, after four back surgeries, it appears to be working. His comeback continues in this weekend's U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills in New York. More from Wall Street Journal sports reporter Brian Costa. Brian, what's up here?
Well, you know, he's had a successful return from his fourth back surgery now, and part of his routine in coming back is taking ibuprofen in the middle of his rounds, just as more of a preventative thing than actual, to deal with pain necessarily. He says the surgeon says to take it all day.
So how unusual is this for him?
Well, this is, I don't know what his routine was before. It's been so long since he's actually, was not coming off back surgery. But certainly for this one, this is something that, he's done to sort of help sort of ward off the back pain that has come back to him again and again. And it's something that a lot of people in a lot of sports do. People use ibuprofen not just because something hurts and they want it to go away, but because they think something might hurt if they run that race or, do that workout. And so they take it in advance to try to sort of ward off the pain, which, doctors have sort of different opinions about the advisability of that.
Mm. All right, so explain some of that. What doctors are saying, what about this?
Well, it's interesting. There's been a lot of research in recent years about ibuprofen that have pointed out sort of potential side effects ranging from, increased risk of heart attack to, kidney problems. There's even a study about lower male fertility. And so, you have doctors who says, what Tiger is doing is not something, for just a weekend duffer should be emulated. And there are other doctors and surgeons who still feel like, look, this is something that can be smart and reasonable in moderation, and that those side effects can be managed. So it's not like there's universal agreement on what the best approach is.
Speaking with Wall Street Journal sports reporter Brian Costa about his piece about Tiger Woods taking ibuprofen during tournament play. I imagine golfers have all kinds of aches and pains given the nature of the sport, knees, elbows, shoulders, wrists, hands, in addition to back. What do other guys do?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I've heard from a lot of readers in the last 24 hours who are all sort of sharing stories about, here's what bothers me and what I do. And, most people, I think, think of ibuprofen or pain relievers as something that is to relieve pain that already exists. But the reality is that for a lot of endurance athletes and other types of athletes, it's something that they, you know, sensibly or not, turn to sort of as a way to keep them out there even before they feel anything.
What, I mean, if it's ibuprofen, does it escalate at all from there?
You mean like does it lead to more different types of drug use beyond ibuprofen?
I guess, yeah, or you know, is golf worried about the image, perhaps, that, you know, Tiger's popping pills, so to speak, during play?
No, I don't. I mean, you know, this is something that he says is his surgeon has recommended. And, look, I mean, you know, the reality is, you know, there are golfers, and Tiger's one of them, that have used, you know, opioid painkillers at times in their careers to deal with pain and injuries and playing through them. And, you know, whatever you want to say about ibuprofen, I don't think anybody would dispute that it's safer to do that preemptively than to be taking some kind of opioid, which obviously is much more addictive and much more dangerous.
Did you mention something in the story, too, about bananas being almost, if not as equally effective?
Yeah, well, there was one study that came out this year that actually found that the metabolites in bananas perform comparably to ibuprofen in reducing inflammation and supporting the immune system during intense exercise. So, you know, that's something that's sort of raising that possibility is, you know, could you take that instead and get some of the benefits without the side effects? I haven't tried it personally.
Thanks, Brian. Brian Costa, Wall Street Journal sports reporter. It's 30 minutes now after the hour. On This Weekend, you don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, Hawaii and Guatemala are not the only tourist destinations with active volcanoes right now. Also, promoting safe summer driving habits. And the U.S. Open's potentially biggest challenge is off the course. That story in about 20 minutes. But how come more retirees aren't having enough fun? It's not that older adults are glum. They're happier than middle-aged and younger adults, according to researchers at the Stanford Center on Longevity. Stress, anger, and worry decrease with age, but many adults forget how to have fun after rigorous working years, putting the kids through school, etc. Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry looked at the subject and has advice on how to find fun again. Claire, what do you have?
Well, I think that, you know, fun is sort of a natural instinct when you're a child. I mean, it's something that's spontaneous. You want to enjoy yourself. You want to have fun. But then when people start becoming parents and they're devoted to their careers, that sort of spontaneity gets lost, or, you know, you put it aside because life gets serious and you're paying off your house and getting your kids through school, and then you're taking care of your aging parents, and people kind of forget how to have fun.
I thought it was interesting. You kind of profiled one guy who said he was doing some research and found all these experts on, like, geriatric care or different, you know, aging questions, but nothing about fun.
Right. And he was, I mean, the point he was trying to make is, like, he was looking to study leisure and, you know, what people do in their leisure. And so he was trying to find somebody who could be an expert on that. And he said, you know, we have all these experts on things that are just make aging sound awful or depressing. And, you know, it's a time to have fun because retirees have much more free time. So they have the time to have fun. And sometimes because they've forgotten, they need a little help guiding them or at least encouraging them.
So what are some ideas, what you find that folks are doing?
Well, it's, you know, fun can, it's as long as it's something that you choose and that you enjoy, it can be something physical, pickleball, hiking. One woman loves to ride roller coasters, and she luckily has a couple of childhood friends who love to ride roller coasters with her. Some people love to golf. Some people hate to golf. some people think that you can't, that the best part of fun is being with other people, which is a, you know, that's sort of an antidote to loneliness, which, you know, can cause a lot of depression as people go older if they don't have any social outlet or any sort of, you know, connection. But fun can also, for some people, just be birding. I shouldn't say just, but, you know, birding, bird watching, mm-hmm. or being in a book club. I got an email from a guy this morning who said, oh, you forgot auto racing. You know, he and his buddies are in their 70s and they race cars. So it really can be a lot of different things. As long as it's, you know, an activity that's not chosen for you. Something that gives you enjoyment, kind of a distraction. You know, some people feel like fun is what they do to distract them from what they may be worrying about. So it doesn't have to be physical, but, you know, physical does have its benefits in terms of getting people moving and often outside and, you know, just stimulating.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry. She's written a piece entitled An Overlooked Skill in Aging, How to Have Fun. What was this older adult playfulness scale that you wrote about?
Yeah, that was a couple of researchers back in 2011 were looking at play. They were actually in the tourism area of research, but also had an interest in aging. And they found all of this study and research on kids and even young adults, but they didn't find anything for older adults. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was they got focus groups and interviewed people about, you know, the characteristics of people that they think are fun and of their own characteristics when they're fun, or when they're having most fun. And they just found that they're, you know, psychologically upbeat, you know, and they had, you know, 15 different characteristics, and they were happier, you know, they were just more upbeat and more positive. So, you know, there hasn't been a lot of research about, you know, sort of the scientific benefits and or the health benefits, but you know, they're saying that, you know, it points to improved well-being.
Thanks, yeah. Claire. Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry. It is 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. While the devastating volcanic eruptions that have hit Hawaii's Big Island and Guatemala may seem like rare events, eruptions are more common than one might expect. On any given day, MarketWatch reporter Jacob Passy says roughly 20 volcanoes are actively erupting. Jacob, what's up here?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of articles about the eruptions that have gone on in Hawaii and Guatemala. I mean, these were pretty destructive. You know, tons of property were damaged in Hawaii, scores of people lost their lives, and, you know, for a lot of people, it seems like this is, you know, unusual, you know, that you know, when's the last time you heard about something like this happening, but it, you know, it really actually, it turns out that volcanic eruptions are far more common than you might think. A researcher I spoke with told me that anywhere from like 20 to 25 volcanoes are actively erupting on any given day. You know, a lot of these volcanoes are not necessarily near, you know, major population centers, so that's why you might not think about them as often, but you know, there are tons of volcanoes around the world, some that are actively erupting, some that are just, you know, active, which, you know, means that they could erupt at some point in the near future, and then plenty of, you know, dormant volcanoes that are no longer active, that we just think of probably as, you know, mountains and things like that. So,
well, I was going to say that was one thing that jumped out at me. I didn't, you know, having been on Mount Rainier a little bit, spent some time there, I didn't realize that was a volcano.
Yeah, so Mount Rainier is a volcano. It's not erupted in quite some time. Basically, you know, Mount Rainier is in a dormant phase, but it's known as one of the so-called decade volcanoes. This was a list that experts came up with of 16 volcanoes around the world that they think need to be studied further because of past large destructive eruptions that they have had and their proximity to major population centers. So Rainier in throughout history has been, you know, the source of massive volcanic eruptions, and researchers think that those could happen in the future, not necessarily, you know, right now or anything like that, but you know, the possibility does exist, and if it were to happen, you know, for a variety of reasons, it would be particularly destructive, not just because it's right near Seattle, less than 60 miles from Seattle, but also because, unlike a lot of, currently active volcanoes, those are hot, they don't allow ice buildup, but because Rainier has been dormant in a dormant phase for a while, there's a large amount of glacial ice that accrue on the top. I mean, that's what gives you those beautiful photos of that, snow-capped mountain in the background in Seattle. But that ice, if there were to be an eruption, would obviously quickly melt and could trigger, massive mudslides and things that could be quite destructive, especially in the Seattle region.
We're speaking with Jacob Passy, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. Speaking of big population centers, I think you point out in the story, we always think of Mexico City as earthquake problem area, but it too has a volcano?
So there is a volcano outside of Mexico City called Popocatépetl, and it is, it's an active volcano. It often is emitting, gas and ash, but its activity has picked up, in recent years, and that's causing concern that it could really put Mexico City in danger.
Thanks, Jacob. Jacob Passy, Market Watch reporter. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Glad you could spend some time with us. On average, distracted driving kills nearly 10 people in the U.S. each day. In 2016, nearly 1 in 10 drivers, 15 to 19 years old, who were involved in fatal crashes were reported as being distracted at the time of the crash. This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka has a look at a new awareness campaign.
As teens and vacationers hit the road for a summer vacation, Project Yellow Light is campaigning to promote safe driving habits. Joining us to talk about the program is its founder, Julie Garner. Julie, why did you start Project Yellow Light?
Well, it's a sad story. My son, Hunter, was killed when he was 16 years old due to a car crash involving distracted driving. And at that point, my husband, daughter, and I knew we had to do everything in our power to save other young people from dying needlessly due to a car crash. And in this instance, one that can be prevented, because the majority of crashes with our youth are because of distractions. And our program focuses on texting and driving in particular, which is one of the major distractions out there.
Julie, how did you come up with the name Project Yellow Light?
It actually was a coworker of mine at my office who had kind of taken it his cue from Project Green Light, which was a video competition back about 10, 12 years ago. And we started out with video, but we now actually have three components, video, radio, and TV, out of house, billboards.
Explain that a little bit more. What do you mean by the three elements?
Well, it's a scholarship competition where high school juniors and seniors and college students, we have two levels to the competition, apply, and they create public service ads. So it's either a radio spot or a TV spot or a billboard design. And we select winners from all three competitions, and they also win a scholarship money, but they also have their work promoted all over the country through the Ad Council, iHeartRadio, and Clear Channel Outdoor. And we just got through announcing our latest 2018 winners in New York this past Friday. And Clear Channel gives us space in Times Square where the winner's work is displayed on one of the big boards, and it's just amazing.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. So what will be the X factor at the 2018 U.S. Open? Will it be lightning fast greens, punishing rough, swirling winds? Nope. The For the Win blog at USA Today says it might be the Long Island traffic. Seriously, that's why Tiger Woods is staying in his dinghy, a $20 million yacht that's parked in nearby Sag Harbor. That's why Jason Day parked his RV right outside the course. Woods says there are players who've taken some 3 hours to get to the course from a nearby hotel. He thinks it's not inconceivable a player could miss their tee time. Ryan Fox probably learned his lesson. He was late to his practice round earlier this week. Paul Casey got stuck, as did amateurs like Jacob Bergeron. Even media members staying 45 minutes west of the course are running into the same heavy traffic areas, prompting USGA Executive Director Mike Davis to issue an apology. Authorities made some changes, like traffic lights turning into flashing lights to prevent stops and starts, but this is much more of a problem for players. You would think that the threat of missing a tee time means they'd all get up a little earlier than usual to travel, but will that throw off anyone's rhythm? For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.